I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. We talked last time about Korea, and while we were talking about Korea and we were watching what was happening with Korea, a lot of stuff has rolled over the shore of dealing with Iran. We've had a number of incidences with them. The biggest one was the capture of the U.S. soldier, or U.S. sailors, I should say, and what happened there. Jim, could you set that up a little bit for us?
Well, Iran, of course, is free from most of the sanctions, or is becoming free. It's a gradual process. And this is causing great consternation in the Arab world, the Gulf Arabs in particular, because they are literally at war with Iran, have been for some time. Actually, depending on how you define hot war and cold war, they've been at war with Iran for centuries. The big change was oil. When the oil came in, finally the Arabs had a chance of meeting the Iranians on somewhat equal terms, at least in terms of, you know, money. The Iranians, among their many accomplishments, have always been more productive than the Arabs in the region. Now, part of that has to do with geography. Iran sits on a more of a, you know, a well-watered, they got more water. They have had agriculture and industry that is more compatible with what we're used to in the West for a long time. The Persians have been great innovators for thousands of years. For example, they had plate armor more than 1,000 years before Europeans did. The list of their technical accomplishments, especially in military matters, is frighteningly long. But obviously they got overwhelmed, like everybody else in the region did, when the Europeans took off after the Renaissance, the industrialization and what have you. That caught them, that blindsided them. They had been an empire. Actually, they still are an empire. What's left of the Iranian empire today is only 50% ethnic Iranian. The other half is various, conquered peoples. A quarter of the population are Turks, the Azerbaijani, who are actually very loyal members and prominent in the leadership of the current religious government. But they have a lot of minorities who are not so loyal and prominent in the leadership.
The Baluchis.
Baluchis, which are sort of, somewhat more civilized Pashtuns. And, of course, they have about 2% of the population is Arab. Then they have Kurds. Everybody in that region has Kurds. It's course of, entry. But the big problem for the Arabs is that for a long time, the Iranians never bothered to conquer Arabia because there was no there. I mean, it was Mecca, but the Turks grabbed that. The Iranians were never that fanatic about religion. They adopted Shia more as a political move than a religious move. They don't like to talk about that these days, but that's the histories are fairly clear. The whole business of Shia versus Sunni is more factional political politics within the Islamic world than any true religious belief. But in the last century or so, it's become set in stone. There haven't been a lot of people, shifting en masse from Shia to Sunni, back and forth and what have you. And when oil was introduced about 80 years ago in the 1930s, and the income really skyrocketed with OPEC, with the with the cartel in the 70s, that changed everything. Suddenly people had money to buy all those neat Western toys, especially the weapons. And Iran had the misfortune, just as that was getting going, to have a religious revolution. Now, the Iranians, again, this is unique to Iran. Iran has a long history of you know, secular monarchies. And they, one of the few rare times they were defeated by outsiders was when they were having internal, you know, they were constantly fighting, where they couldn't fight outsiders, which they were very good at. They fight each other, which they were too good at, and that would weaken the empire, so to speak. That's how Alexander the Great got in, and that's how the Arabs got in. The problem is that the Arabs introduced Islam, which was a radically different religion from what they had been using up to that point, which was mainly the fire god. It was more of an Iranian religion, not an outside religion. That's why Christianity never caught on in a big way. Suddenly they had this alien influence. That's one reason why they ended up a Shia, to differentiate themselves from those damn Arabs, who they never cared for too much. Now, that did not become an issue until the religious, the Shia, unlike the Sunni, had a tradition of participation in the government. I mean, literally, you know, not just, you know, hey, I'm a politician, I go to the mosque, and that's about it, pray. The clergy wanted to run things, and they wanted a piece of the action, as it were. They have an activist clergy, especially in Iran. Now the emperors, the kings, the shahs, whatever you want to call them, especially the last shah's father, he had basically told them, you know, it's you either bow down to me or it's a river of blood. I'll just keep killing, you know, the old-fashioned way, which is literally how they settled disputes like this in the past. And the Ayatollahs and the clerics there simply bowed down and said, okay, but they waited. And they finally got the chance in the 70s, and that is basically, in a way, it's hampered Iranian, imperial ambitions, because it weakened Iran militarily, economically, because the clerical government was far more corrupt and inefficient than whatever the Shahs had. And, of course, they brought upon themselves a lot of international economic sanctions because they were basically getting into, religious fanaticism overseas. Now, they did it much more smoothly than the Arabs were doing it, but, you know, they couldn't keep it a secret for long. And that's why they had this huge pile of sanctions on them. Now they are starting to get rid of those sanctions, and they still have the potential to build nuclear weapons. It's like what we were talking about back in 2003. You know, we've had these discussions. Go back and read the old, strategy page material from back then. You know, we pointed out that Saddam, even if he took apart his nuclear weapons program, he could reconstitute it, very quickly. And of course, it later came out, Saddam admitted after he was captured that, yes, he had basically dismantled the weapons of mass destruction programs, but he had basically kept it. He kept the people, he kept all the records, as it were, but he kept the illusion that he still had it because he wanted to keep the Iranians out. He felt that if the Iranians knew he had truly gotten rid of all that stuff, that they would come after him again, because he was basically hated in a big way by the Iranians because of the stalemate in the 1980s war. Now, the Iranians are not used to stalemates with the Arabs. They were literally out to basically reconquer what the Turks had taken away from them. You know, now the Turks were pretty formidable, and the Persians, the Iranians, respected the Turks. So there was peace there for centuries, where the borders are now. But when the Turkish Empire fell, in 1918 after World War I, and the Westerners came in, then the West basically went to the Iranians and said, look, we're going to set the Arabs free, and you guys can basically work out whatever antagonisms you have. We're not going to get involved. Just don't screw with the oil. Now, that was fine as long as you had a Shah. But now you got to remember, you got to be old, I think, or be willing to dig around in the internet, because I was alive and practicing this pundit business, back in the 60s. and 70s. And it was in the news that the Shah was looking at the Arabs. And there was a big to-do in politics and diplomacy at that time. Again, you can go back. This is not, you know, this is not a conspiracy theory. This would actually happen. There were serious fears that we were arming the Shah because he was a stalwart anti-communist ally. But he was, a lot of his generals were saying, a lot of his, you know, senior officials saying, you know, maybe we should, if we wanted to have peace in the Middle East, maybe we should control all that Arab oil. And that was a big brouhaha. Some people thought that with the religious revolution, it was no longer a problem. They didn't realize the problem had just gotten worse because now you had a fanatical religious, you know, an Islamic Republic, which was talking even worse, you know, aggression, than the Shah or any of the Shahs had for centuries. They were basically talking about taking on the West, which the Shah, you know, they could do the math. They said, all right, let's be friends with these Westerners, especially the Americans, because they're basically, you know, too powerful to fight. But the clerics don't believe in that. Now, what's going to change today, this very day? It's election day in Iran. Now, what's important about this election is that you had a realignment in the last few years among the ruling clerics. Now, you got to understand, in the Iran, the clerics have the last word, but they don't run the country. It works like this. There's a senior council of guardians, so to speak, that's what they literally call it, who have veto power over anything the government does. Now, they exercise this, again, the typical Iranian fashion, with a light touch, as it were. They don't basically, you know, run around giving orders and what have you. For example, they can approve or disapprove any candidate for parliament. I mean, they have had a parliament, you know, since the 1980s. But the clerics, being Iranians, realize, well, that's what they do. This is simply to control who can run. And we'll make sure we only get our guys in there. Now, for the last 20 years, they've had more and more of the approved candidates turned out to be outright reformers. Some of them were even clerics. And this has been a problem for the hardliners. What makes this election different is that even though the hardliners, who are not a majority, you know, in the Guardians, they don't control, you know, the Guardians Council, but they tried as hard as they could to get out all the true reformers. But it turned out when the campaigning started, all the approved candidates started, you know, running for seats in parliament, it turns out a lot of these guys that on paper appeared to be, you know, hardliners, you know, radicals for years, suddenly they were talking about reform. And this has got the hardliners, who basically, you know, have their support, maybe 10-20% of the population. Most of the rest don't really care as long as they can basically, you know, live their lives and you can reduce the corruption. Most of the corruption is because of the clerics, because the clerics basically have power without responsibility. And they've basically gone to the bank, literally, with it. So any attempts to clean up the corruption have run into a wall of clerics who are willing to call you un-Islamic and do all sorts of other nasty stuff in order to hang on to their money. So, you know, just because you're very religious doesn't mean you're morally pure. So today's election, when the dust settles, and it'll take about a week, you know, for everything to get voted and agreed upon, we're going to see if they're really moving towards, you know, ending the religious dictatorship, which since the 1980s, that's what it's been. And there's a lot of, there's two things going on in Iran, demographically. First, 70-80% of the population was born after the revolution. You know, it's a very young population. Because during the 1980s, when the clerics usurped the democracy, in other words, when the Shah came down, the religious participants in that revolution against the Shah had agreed. And again, this is a matter of public record. You can go back and read about it. The internet makes it very easy to go look at old newspapers and what have you. They agreed that there would be free elections and that people would decide. But because Saddam, you know, the Arabs never miss an opportunity. When he invaded, under the delusion that, you know, because of the disorder in Iran, the revolution, the Iranian army was weakened, he could grab their oil, most of their oil fields, which are right next to Iraq, and most of the population there is Arab. Well, that failed within weeks, and the Iranians did what the Iranians normally do. They organized and they counterattacked, and you had this, you know, 500,000 people killed over the next 8 years before there was a stalemate. This allowed the religious leadership under the, you know, the guise of, hey, patriotism for the motherland, et cetera, Allah, you know, save us, because it was a desperate war. I mean, they basically had purged most of a lot of the professional officers in the military because these guys were pro-Shah, and they basically fled the country. And even a lot of the ones who stayed and fought, you know, were suspect. So they hurt their military power, which in normal times would just roll over the Arabs, especially Iraqis. This was seen as a great humiliation. But that allowed basically the clerics to impose all these temporary emergency measures, like the guardians and what have you, and basically they hijacked the government. And they did it in such a way, again, the Iranians have a way of doing things, which we describe as Byzantine or Suave, depending on your attitude. And they got away with it, and they have held on to it ever since. And that has created a lot of resentment among Iranians who basically lived through it. But most Iranians know nothing about that. They basically grew up, and then, of course, they became, as they got older, they realized, gee, the country isn't as efficient as Grandpa said it used to be, under the hated Shah. And a lot of them said, gee, I'd love to go to hate America, you know, the great Satan, because that's the place where Iranians are free. So you had this very complicated situation where less and less of the population were believing in, you know, what the hardline clerics were selling. And it's reached a point where the hardliners are really, literally in fear of losing control. And a lot of them are also in fear of going to jail or being executed for economic crimes or whatever. Although the Iranians, again, the way they do things, they'd simply demote a lot of these guys. I mean, some people will go to jail. A few might get killed. But basically, the religious, the clergy are in very real danger of losing power. And it's all going to be done by way of a system that the clerics themselves invented. But that will change things radically, and not for the better, because even with a democratically elected government in Iran, they still have the ambitions that the Shah had. He had basically a constitutional monarchy, one the English used to have about 100 and some odd years ago. But anyway, even then it was popular to the idea of, well, we should control all of the Middle East. They resented the fact that the Westerners had come in after the Turks, you know, Turkish Empire collapsed. And they felt, you know, they should be the ones to pick up the pieces. They basically have these resentments. I mean, this is something that we know about the Arabs and their crazy ideas about, you know, well, we write about it frequently in strategy page. But the Iranians also have a lot of these crazy ideas of what they're entitled to. But the problem with the Iranians is they're much more efficient. They've always been much more prosperous. And what's hurting them now, and what you have to watch very carefully, along with their allies, the Russians, is the most powerful weapon the Arabs have is their control over the price of oil. Now, the Russians are very unhappy with this, because this is one of the main things that brought down the Soviet Empire. Towards the end, you know, the Soviet Empire was very inefficient. They didn't have clerics. Well, they did after a fashion. They had this centrally controlled communist government, economy, which is terribly inefficient. But by the 80s, the only thing that was keeping the Soviet Union afloat was oil income. Basically, it still is. When the Saudis, basically as part of their support for the fight against godless Russia in Afghanistan, went along with the American suggestion, though, well, why don't we hit them with the oil, you know, weapon? And that was one of the, you know, the last straws, as it were, that broke the back of the Soviet Empire. The Russians still resent that. And here they are, the Arabs are doing it again. So that's why they're so tight with the Iranians. And of course, the Russians do have nuclear weapons. very openly and in great profusion. And they are hand in hand with the Iranians because they have several things in common. One of them being this low price of oil is hurting both of them. More the Russians than the Iranians, actually. The Iranians have a more diversified economy than Russia. The Iranians are, so to speak, more efficient than the Russians. Russians don't like to discuss that. You know, the Russians, for example, they took on the Iranian Empire and got bounced back. Said, "Oh, I believe these guys alone." In fact, several times Stalin wanted to basically redress that insult, you know, to Russia, but the West basically got them to back off. So you got to understand that there are things going on with Iran and in the Middle East that get very little or no coverage in the Western media. You know, the Western media tends to invent other fictions for whatever reason about what's going on in there. But if you simply read what the people themselves there were reporting and going through, you see that it's quite a different world. It's quite a different environment. And Iran is dangerous, but not for the reasons most people think.
Austin, what do you think about the current situation in Iran?
Well, let me pick up on it. I mean, Jim gave you let's make 2,800 year history. Okay, one thing I'd add to it, you know, his point about pre-Islamic. Iranian or Aryan religions. Remember, Iranistan means Aryanistan. They're the real Aryans, is there?
They're our cousins.
They claim. Actually, that Indo-European, you know, the Aryan.
They're right in the middle of it.
And they are, and running from the Aryans in the northern India, all the way to Ireland and then further on expansion. But in some ways they are, I'm making a judgment call here, but it's one that Jim may laugh about this, heavily influenced by my Arab friends. But they're the most racist of Aryans, meaning the Iranians. That's part of what Jim sketched.
Well, they've had more practice.
That's it. That's the whole point. They've been face to face with them for, you know,
even closer to the Chinese, even closer to the Arabs.
I really don't want to blow back on that. That's the kind of the thing like where Poles have to say about Russians, okay? That's, even though they have gotten along with them, the Poles just run Russians down ethnically all the time. Don't hear about it very much, but it's because the Poles run the Germans down, and you can understand why. They've been gobbled up from both sides, and Arabs feel that certainly about the Iranians. But I think I'll use an anecdote to express this, Dan, and it does say something about the current situation. That's one of the reasons Jim touched on it with the religious differences. I have a good acquaintance who married an Iranian woman, about 35 years ago. They had a service here in the United States, a Christian service, and then went back to her home. He met her here in the States, and went back to her home and had a religious service in this really small town that she was from. And yes, it was overseen by an Islamic Shia priest, and there was a Quran there. But what he told me, he said, and his wife was right there with him. It was at a party in the 1990s. What he told me was, it was a Zoroastrian service in some ways. And his wife grins because she knew exactly what he meant. I mean, it's in also Sprach Zarathustra, the Zoroastrian. And he said there were things that went on with it. And he talked to the priest about it, of course, through a translator, but a priest admitted it. And this is some of the things when you just get from the Sunnis, particularly in the really puritanical Sunni states like Saudi Arabia. See, they're really very syncretic. They're criticizing Shias and folk religion, and then, of course, the Iranians are big fakes. Well, Jim said that. There were a lot of political reasons that the Iranians adopted Shiism, and part of it was to differentiate themselves from the quote-unquote Arab mainline, and therefore become the political protector or spokesman for Shia Arabs. If there was a political move, and where is a abundance of most Shia Arabs are in the Mesopotamian region. I won't say all. Of course they aren't. There's the so-called Shia arc, and then you have other scattered Shia communities. So that was there. That was a choice made, and we see that being played out, too, with it's not the only reason the Iranians finagle with Iraq, but it's a tool for finagling with Iraq. So I'll just pick up on that, because that's also, it ties to an Iranian vision of being, see the same thing out of the Chinese here, the center of the earth. And they were extremely powerful in the 6th and 5th and 4th century B.C. And they were very, central time in the development of spread of the agricultural revolution, as Jim said, development of industry. They had a huge empire. It was only destroyed by Alexander the Great after the Battle of Gaugamela. But it still wasn't destroyed. Alexander was one of the kind of conquerors that said, "Hi, now I'm in charge. You keep running things. Just don't bother us Macedonians and pay tribute and recognize that I'm the boss." Okay, so the thing about the Persian Empire, as it was too, you had lots of satraps that resented the Persians. As Jim was talking about contemporary Iran, it's not a one-for-one analogy, Dan, but there are numerous minorities that utterly resent the Iranians. Jim says that many of the Azeris are part of the regime, co-opted. Kurds are not. Baluchis are not. Arabs are not. And even though they're Shia Arabs living on, Western Iran. So there you have an elements that at least have a little connection, look a little bit like what that Persian Empire was in the 5th century BC. And you have senior Iranian leaders. Now they're almost, the important players are all radical Shia clerics, but they still have this vision that we ought to be a major player on the planet. We were made to be that. That was one of the appeals that the Ayatollah Khomeini had with his global revolution. And this is something that Jim and I have both written about in Quick and Dirty Guide to War and in other places about the Iranian imperial or nationalist element of Khomeini's appeal. It wasn't strictly Islamic. The leadership was coming from Iran. Anyway, that's pick that up. The one other thing that Jim mentioned too that's absolutely critical is that this group that usurped the Iranian revolution against the Shah, which was supposed to be democratic. And the first president elected was really a moderately leftist intellectual, Abul Hassan Bani Sadr. Now, he reappeared in January of 2011 to write a very fine essay that was dedicated to the Tunisian people because of the Tunisians being the first Arab Spring Revolution, and saying you must have a common front among those of you who are dedicated to truly reforming Tunisia and getting rid of the autocrats, and you got to stick together, because if you don't, you'll repeat our mistake and the most vicious and most violent will win. Now, I'm paraphrasing what he wrote, but I actually used his essay in a couple of columns I wrote the spring of 2011, and he was talking about what happened by the Khomeinis when, even though the Ayatollah Khomeini was the figure, central figure in the Iranian Revolution of 1979, that isn't what the people wanted. Was a Khomeiniist theological dictatorship. And Bonnie Sutter was went into exile. Most of all of the communists, all the nationalists had fled. The monarchists had fled, and there was still a strong nationalist element, and there was a strong pro-Western element that was certainly not communist. If anything, Bonnie Sutter was somebody who was impressed by France, and then also some of the other European self-styled social democracies. They were toppled by a coup d'etat of the most militant, and the Revolutionary Guards were used by the Khomeinists to intimidate, murder, and ultimately arrest all of the opposition, which fragmented. And then now Khomeini starts. Then the quest for nuclear weapons starts sometime in the 1980s. Some of it was certainly propaganda, but there was also absolute general interest in getting it because it was a weapon that they could a regime protection weapon to threaten U.S. and West and European interests with retaliation, and it was also something that if they got, they could use to threaten Saddam Hussein, who did invade them. Remember, they were having they had the great Iran-Iraq war, or intimidate the Persian Gulf Arab Emirates. It'd be a useful tool for intimidating those Arabs who control the price of oil. Jim's already talked about that. One other thing I would pick up, Green Movement, June 2009. There was an expression down around an election of a large plurality, if not a majority, of Iranian voter. That would include some of the disenchanted ethnic groups, but also plenty of the educated, aspirational, not necessarily the educated elites, people within Iran who wanted what they really wanted, was what the revolution had promised. Well, that was broken up by current religious leaders. And here we are in 2016, and some of the mid-level green movement leaders, I'm not going to come up with names right now, but they're still in jail. There are some that are under essentially house arrest. They're not in jail, but they're extremely limited in what they can do. They certainly can't engage in political activity. There's some views that current President Rouhani is a closet moderate, whatever that might be. However, what happened building up to the election, and which is going on today, as we take this, so we don't have the results, but we already do have the results. Because what I followed the last couple of months, and I'd like to hear Jim to chime in on this, is that the religious leaders have culled, eliminated, purged, pick your word, any candidate that they don't approve of. In other words, you're left with just nothing but hardliners that to be elected in the parliamentary election. And so in that sense, they're having an election, but the candidates are of all one ideological stripe. Who knows, maybe two or three are left out there so they can show them to election observers that there's a broader spectrum of opinion, but that's not according to the reports that I've been consistently reading, and some of them are from, you know, Iranians, and it gets translated from the Farsi into English. One of the things, the arguments made about the so-called treaty, and yes, we've talked about this. I think everybody knows what my view is on that Iranian nuclear arms permission treaty. I think it's a huge mistake. But one of the arguments early on was, well, it will strengthen Rouhani's hand because he will be able to tout to the electorate that he got the sanctions removed, which is highly popular. But it hadn't done anything to stop an Iranian bomb. And that's I've been engaged a couple of times in heavy debates about that point. But go through the text and look at the holes in there regarding many of the sites that essentially the Iranian government, which is still run by the senior clerics, can just keep playing games forever and deny close inspection to some of the most critical sites. So that's a huge failure. That's a huge mistake in that treaty. And the fact that if they have gone and culled and purged all of the could be Rouhani supporters, then Rouhani hadn't been strengthened at all. Despite the popularity of the elimination or reduction of sanctions. That has occurred. I mean, you can see that in the Iranian press and also some of the polls and some of the Western media that are in there. And it's understandable, I would. Now they can get some of their frozen cash out of those out of those accounts, and they have access to Western goods and Eastern goods that they want, and Rouhani gets credit for that. But it's not going to pay off at the. It looks like it's not going to pay off at the ballot box. So I that's some of the things that's going on right now. One other point, since we really are a security. Oriented, defense and security oriented website. What's that money going to be used for, Ben? Well, Jim and I have discussed this before. It's going to be an arms purchasing spree by the Iranians. Maybe a lot of that money will be spent in Russia. And Jim's already pointed about the common interest of the Kremlin and Tehran. So. That's another common interest, because the Russians sure would like the Iranians to buy some weapons from them, and they're going to have hard currency to do it. And I'll leave it right there, Dan.
So, Jim, is there anyone that's going to try to halt what Iran's doing as far as its aggression in the area, its rearming, whether it continues to break the sanctions? Or not break the sanctions, but break their agreement with the Western nations over their nuclear development?
Well, the Israelis point out quite accurately that they are the primary objective of the radicals in Iran. I mean, the radicals are regularly preaching, you know, death to Israel, we're going to destroy Israel. They get very specific at times. The majority of Iranians don't want this. They don't want a world war that they know they will lose. And the problem is that nobody knows quite how to handle them. Nobody wants another war against the Iranians. So fighting Arabs is bad enough. You go against the Iranians, then it gets really ugly really fast. And then, of course, the Iranians have this alliance with the Russians. See, the Iranians are very clever. They choose their friends and enemies, you know, most carefully. You know, the Iranians make no secret of the fact they feel their dominance of the region is inevitable. And they don't even have to point to the fact that nobody is making any serious efforts to stop that. And, you know, that's just what the Iranians have taken advantage of for thousands of years. And it really hasn't changed. Because a lot of people know, they don't want to come out and say it, that if the Iranians did grab the Arabs, And then, of course, they have all kinds of grief, you know, trying to control the, you know, occupying the Arabs. But then they've done that before, and they probably could, if they went back to their old school methods, they would, you know, just, even if they got expelled from the UN or whatever, they realize that, you know, nobody who's got half a brain is willing to take them on. But they would continue to sell their oil. You know, the Iranians are people that you can always do business with. They don't have to say that because they just, you know, people go look at the record. They have a track record, they could say, in business. And that's what makes the Iranians so scary. They're efficient and they can prove.
Austin, you want to give us any wrap up here as we run out of time?
I don't know that I'd add anything beyond what I had to say about the current situation. Obviously, we don't know the future. Yes, I am very suspicious of the very flawed. I know I call it a treaty. It's really an agreement that wasn't approved.
Yeah, it can officially be a treaty.
Yeah,
yes.
It's being called that, Dan, overwhelmingly call it, but it's not because it certainly wasn't ratified by the U.S. Senate and didn't follow the protocols of a treaty. I think it's flawed. I think it's fatally flawed. Are there genuine quote unquote moderates? And I mean that in the sense of let's connect with the rest of the planet and not be at war with everybody. This didn't come up. Let me add this. Last edition of Quick and Dirty Guide to War, I think it's 2008. We had Iran involved in 18 different conflicts, and they were an aggressor in all of them. And it could be more. It depends, because a couple of the way the conflicts were shaped, there were really four or five sub-conflicts within those. That's a hallmark of an aggressive regime, and they're still involved in every one of them, plus more because of their engagement in Syria since the book's publication in 2008. Are there Iranians that don't want to do that? Yes, they're successfully oppressed and suppressed. And the regime knows how to take out that green movement, which, and I said it was a large plurality, it may be, in terms of numbers of people, Dan, a majority within Iran. And they really don't have a voice. And if they can knock off, topple the dictatorship, which is hard to do, then, you know, that agreement isn't going to matter. Because you're not going to have that aggressive regime, and right now, as I see it, the theocrats are getting money. They've got prestige. They have a ongoing and developing alliance with an aggressive regime in Moscow. That's pretty dire. That's not a roundup, Dan. That's a lead into a discussion. You know, maybe in a year when we see what happens.
Okay. All right. Well, we will talk to you gentlemen next time.
Take care. Bye, guys. Bye.